Nick Ashew on the Fan. We got Team USA 4-1 win over Paraguay last night to start off the World Cup. I mean, it is, we got some star power. It's generally in the U.S., so there's a home field kind of feel to it. I don't know. It's very early, but there is this feeling of this energy, and like we were talking about earlier in the show, right? Events, people gravitate to events in this country. The College World Series, everybody wants to know, oh, what's going on in Omaha? Or, you know, the World Cup. Even everybody who doesn't even care about the Knicks or the NBA suddenly wants to be courtside at a Knicks game. Taylor Swift, I'm sure she's a Knicks fan. I'm going to keep saying I don't care. It's just, it drives me nuts because it just feels so phony. I was telling my wife that. She's like, who cares? I'm like, I know. I care because it's fake. Whatever. Anyway, it's, I don't know why this is an axe I need to grind. Andrew Passaro jumps on with me now, the Plus Money Pod. I just want to start with what the U.S. did last night, the 4-1 win. I'm going to leave it kind of open to you because there are a lot of things being said about this game and about this team, and I know you can probably put it in perspective, but it feels like one of those great wins for this program over, really, it's history in the World Cup.
That's exactly right. This is historically, that is the most goals in one singular game the United States men's national team has ever scored in a World Cup game. They haven't scored three goals in a game since the 2002 World Cup in South Korea and Japan. They haven't scored and beaten a team by three goals since the 1930 World Cup. We are talking about something that hasn't happened in almost 100 years. And I expected goals early. I had first half over 1.5 goals at plus 235. I didn't expect the U.S. to be out there playing that way against a pretty strong defensive Paraguay side, and they handed to them in that first half and took care of business in the second half. And that last goal by Gio Reyna was the icing on top of the cake, or I guess the cherry on top of the icing, because Gio Reyna was a player in the last World Cup that we were really excited about. He was young. He was playing on a good team in Germany. And since then, his career has not gone the way that we wanted to. And then he just went out and scored not just a big goal, but the way he scored it and the confidence that he has and the fact that he may be starting, he may be coming off the bench, the fact that he's flying and ready after a strong opening game. I thought this team was at best going to reach the round of 16. I think now we could start thinking about a quarterfinal run. And then when you're in the quarterfinals, anything is possible. But it's one game. I'm trying to, like, not get ahead of myself here. But that is what we wanted to see for a long time.
But, you know, it's true. It's hard to not get ahead of yourself a little bit given what you saw. And, again, game by game, it can obviously be different. But there is a level of energy that's there, right? There's this just feeling of this feeling different. Like, the program as a whole has elevated. And, you know, for so long, the conversation's been about Christian Pulisic and, you know, obviously the star power that he has and sort of elevating the just, you know, the ability to have young players that will play at higher levels around the world playing for this team. But now it's kind of feeling like we've added more levels of young star power to them too.
This team is the deepest I think that we've had at a World Cup or at any tournament. And I'm not trying to, like, put down the great teams that we had in the early 90s, especially the team that hosted in 94. But when you look at this roster of players, there's so many guys that are playing for top tier teams across Europe, which is the highest level of the game. And they're not just, oh yeah, this is a guy who comes in off the bench. We're talking about starters. Like, you know, Chris Richards, who played in the center of defense last night, had 83 perfect passing, was dictating the game from the base of the defense for the U.S. He's been a part of trophy-winning teams for Crystal Palace the last two seasons. They won a trophy in Europe this year. They won the FA Cup in the Premier League the year before. There's guys who are experienced that are winning things and are, I don't even know if they're truly at their, like, physical prime yet. And there's more guys coming through. So this is, if you're new to the game, this is something that, you know, we haven't always seen from the U.S., but this is an exciting time to start watching these guys, Pulisic plays at Milan, watching them maybe week after week or once a week or whatever. They're a part of big teams and they're key contributors, and we saw them get the best out of each other last night. It's an exciting time to be a U.S. soccer fan right now.
Yeah, and listen, there's a lot of people that are certainly going to helicopter into a point, and I understand that, right? Myself included. I'm so focused on, you know, whether it's Commanders OTAs or the NBA Finals and stuff going on right now that I find myself now just gravitating to this because it obviously is exciting when there's a level of success there. Put in perspective to me, too, what Follerin Balogun, and I hope I said his name right. I'm practicing as much as I can because it feels like he's going to start to become a household name. You know, somebody that decided to choose the U.S. over England when he had the opportunity with his association.
Yeah, so I don't know how to properly pronounce his name. I just go by Flo. That's how he goes. So you're
Flo
Balogun. Everybody's going to know what you're talking about. His goal scoring record when he starts for the U.S. I mean, he scored two last night. I think he had scored a goal in 7 of the 14 games since he had started before last night. So you're seeing a really high return. He's playing. He played this season in Monaco. Had a strong second half of the season. I think there was a stretch there where he scored goals in like 10 of 12 games. Had a really strong end of the season campaign. And he's one of those guys. We see this every World Cup in 2014. People might remember James Rodriguez from Colombia scored that insane goal against, I think it was Uruguay or maybe it was Brazil. Regardless, he earned a move to a bigger club. And the performance that we saw from Flo Balogun, not that the club he's playing at Monaco, he's going, if he plays like this for the 3, 4, 5 games that you know, the U.S. is going to go on in this run. He's going to get a move to, like, potentially a Champions League caliber, you know, Premier League team, maybe a bigger team in Germany or Italy. The sky is the limit for him, and I think he's the big piece that the U.S. and Pulisic needed in particular, of a guy who's going to drop into those half spaces, bring a defender with him, open up a lane for Pulisic to make a dangerous run, open up a lane for his other teammates, and he's just as good, you know, with his feet, that he's not just a goal scorer. He can facilitate and set up things and be a menace in the box for his teammates and for causing defenses a lot of problems. He's a guy that I picked out to be the leading goal scorer for the U.S. at this tournament. And I mean, based on what we saw last night, one of my friends texted me, like, are we thinking Flo Balogun's golden boot for the whole World Cup? And I was like, let's see if that number's in the plus 5,000 range, because we are still kind of getting a little crazy and out of ourselves here. But the next game is against Australia, who a team that I expected them to beat pretty comfortably before this performance. And then Turkey will be a tough test. We'll see if they can get into the next round. But this win with the expanded tournament, I think it doesn't guarantee it, but we are going to see it at least a round of 32 game, barring an epic collapse over the next two games.
Man, it's just great for just, you know, American soccer as a whole and younger kids seeing it. It hopefully makes it more popular, because I would certainly love, and I'm sure you would too, I don't know, the U.S. to be more consistent and maybe more of a, you know, a contender in World Cups down the road, as opposed to like, hey, you got to kind of right this ship a little bit. The better question probably for you is to really just put this in perspective in terms of what having a lot of this young talent will really do for just the overall popularity of soccer in this country, where you're obviously trying to develop a system of young talent that's going to continue to rise the ranks and get to this point.
Certainly. I mean, look, the academy system that the MLS is providing is getting better year after year. Like New York Red Bulls in particular, that's where Tyler Adams came from before he went over to Europe. There's already a kid playing in the Philadelphia Union academy system who Manchester City have, like, as soon as he turned 18, he's going over there, and they signed that when I think he was like 15 and a half. So the system is there. It could always improve. And I think that's a big conversation that the diehard soccer fans are complaining about, the whole pay to play and being on a club team and whatever. But the big thing is, if the U.S. club teams in this country take from the model the same way that the Europeans are developing kids, then we're going to get the best out of these guys, because we certainly have the athletes. And I think, again, you know, I'm 33, so I wasn't really old enough for the 94 World Cup, but I hear so many people that were alive in 94 and how it brought them in at 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. And I think that's what this is going to do, is this is going to change soccer for people under the age of 24 dramatically, because it's maybe I went to a World Cup game with my mom or my dad, and or they went to the fan fest and they got out to the experience. And like, the stuff you're seeing online is like that German fan discovering Waffle House. Like, this is what this is all about. It's not just about, you know, seeing great games on the pitch. It's also about learning about other cultures and finding out, oh, why does this team play this style, or why do they wear this color? And it becomes like a whole joint thing. And that's how people fall in love with the game.
Talking to Andrew Passaro here on The Fan. All right, we got three games coming up today in the World Cup. Obviously, Brazil's the big name playing at 6. I had a friend of mine call me yesterday. He's like, I just need action on the World Cup. Give me something. Give me something. I'm like, honestly, man, I'm not the right person just yet. But, Andrew, you are. If we want to dabble in a little bit of something today, what do you like?
All right, so I've already gone bold. My big call before the World Cup was that this Brazil team is probably the worst team we've seen in quite a while. There's a lot of ego. There's a lot of team. Like, look, when you watch an NBA game and you see one team that's working the press well and the defense works, like kind of like the Spurs have been playing, Brazil's a little bit of the opposite of that. They got three or four guys that want to try to do their own thing. I don't think they're playing as one entire unit. And Morocco is the opposite. They had a great World Cup in 2022. I think they're going to win the group, but I give that at a 4-1. But if you're looking for something just today, I'm on Morocco to have 11 shots in the game. They've hit that in 8 of their last 10 games. They went to the final of the African Championships earlier this season. They've got a really strong unit that knows where each other are, where they are. Like, everybody is, they're tight like a fist, and they play really well. I could see them going on a similar run at this World Cup. The guy that I also like for them, Brahim Diaz, he plays right wing for Real Madrid. He's going to be starting for them at an incredible African Cup of Nations. One shot on target for him is plus 100, so he doesn't even need to score. If the keeper saves it or if it goes in the back of the net, that's going to cash. So Morocco shots and Brahim Diaz shot on targets that I like later.
All right, I'm literally writing this down because I'm probably just going to tail you, to be honest with you, just so I can have some of this. So before you go, you are a Silver Spring native. You feeling good about the Commanders this year?
As long as Jaden Daniels is healthy, we can go anywhere. I love the moves that they made on defense. The picks were great. We gotta let the defensive coordinator cook. We gotta let Dan Quinn cook up a defense. And you know, if we don't have the injury bug like last year, I'm gonna be very excited to be walking down the streets of New York this fall in my Jaden Daniels jersey, going to the bars, watching this team. Hopes are high, and you know what? Growing up in a not-so-great time for, you know, Washington football, it's exciting to have expectations for my football team in the fall.
It does. I mean, it feels great to just – I'm with you, right? To be able to wear anything – and look, whether you like the name or not, it's the name right now. Got to deal with it. But to be able to at least be proud of this team, isn't it a great feeling?
It's the best. It's the best. Like, I missed having to plan my weekend around my football team. Because there was a stretch there where it's like, yeah, they're playing at 1 o'clock. I'm not in the DC area. I have to go out to watch this, or I have to pay to watch this. And it's like, is this worth it? Oh, we know it is. And if we can get the Terry and Jaden connection going, where Terry can stretch the field, that's all I want. Terry's probably the best, like, career-wise player that I've seen for this team. I just want to see that guy go up and break his own touchdown record this summer, or this fall, excuse me. That's what I want. I just want the team to play well, and I want to be entertained. And I think the group that they have, they got younger on defense. Again, I'm not trying to say, oh, yeah, they're going to go win 11 games because it's going to be a tough division. But I think Philly, that locker room seems like a disaster. The Giants have a long way to go. The Cowboys, I still don't think they're that good. I'm not saying they're going to win the division, but I can be delusional enough in the summer to say that and not seem like a total crazy person. And I'll take that right now.
Listen, it's okay to have delusional optimism as a fan, especially when we've suffered as long as we have with this team over the years. I'll take it. Andrew, great to talk to you, man. Thanks for coming on.
This was awesome. Hope you enjoy the World Cup this summer, Mike.
Definitely enjoying it. Andrew Passaro, the Plus Money Pod. Make sure you check that out wherever it is that you get your podcasts, and hope you tailed on a couple of things that he likes in the World Cup as well. You know, it's fun. A little action on, a little dabble, if you will. Our friends over at FanDuel got more than enough offering there for you. So, you know, if you want to just partake, there's plenty of different choices that are there. And you know what? Maybe sometimes just cover your eyes and pick some. Right? No, I would not suggest that. Bet smart always. Always bet smart. Nick Cashew on The Fan. We got breaking NBA news. James Harden has been arrested. Oh, not good. James Harden just broke a couple of minutes ago, arrested this morning in Houston, charged with a misdemeanor on lawful carrying of a weapon. Man, this never works out well. Now, granted, he was booked at 4:57 a.m. That's a long night for him. He was taken into custody at 3:41 a.m. I'm going to guess where he was. Hey, Ben, do you want to guess where James Harden was in Houston at 3:41 a.m.? You want to guess?
Yeah, that's my guess. Some type of club.
Yeah, no, there's not an actual answer for sure. I'm just, we know he partakes in the adult entertainment clubs. He's probably at a strip club. I'm gonna be honest with you, he loves those places there. Let's remember he's had his jersey retired technically at one of them. I don't remember where it was, but listen, you got to be smarter than this.
Atlanta's his next stop.
What's the next stop?
Atlanta. He's gonna go to Magic City.
Oh yeah. Well, listen, that is the iconic place.
Right.
That's for sure. There's not really much more about this. He's gonna be a free agent. The Cavs are probably gonna re-sign him. That's what it sounds like. But the Cavs are gonna look different next year. Now, my theory has been, and it still is that LeBron finishes his career there. One last time, Bronny comes with him. I've been saying this for 3 years, and this is the closest we've ever been to that point. The Cavs had a very expensive roster, and they're probably going to make some trades this offseason. What that looks like, I don't know. It sounds like Evan Mobley's there to stay, for one. Donovan Mitchell, for a while, it was whether or not he wanted to be there. He's kind of made it sound like he wants to stay there now. The Knicks are off the table, which was always the rumor for him. So if you're the Cavs and you keep Evan Mobley and you keep Donovan Mitchell and you re-sign James Harden, I don't really know how that helps you in the playoffs, because it didn't this year, and he never helps anybody in the playoffs consistently. I get it, he had a couple of good games, but like, it's kind of who the Cavs are going to be. But if you add LeBron, I don't know, is that a team that can get back to the Eastern Conference Finals? Look, I keep saying this, but the East is very, very wide open. It's not like you're looking at in the West where it's Thunder or Spurs for the next few years where everybody stays. As long as they stay healthy, I still put the Celtics at the top. As long as, you know, they have their level of health, I think there's some changes coming. I don't think Jaylen Brown's going to get traded, despite some of the rumors that are out there. That team still had too much success with what they've got, and this was the season this past year where the Celtics were supposed to be mailing it in, and it was like, oh wait, we're still winning games. They're too well run of an organization, too smart of a front office. Great coaching. They've got talent. So the Celtics will be right near the top of the Eastern Conference. I'd argue the Pacers are probably going to be there. I hate to say it, but thank God they didn't get that lottery pick. It's going to just drive me insane, a full tank, and for that team to go to the finals and then get a top five pick, it made me want to vomit. Thank God that didn't happen. But, you know, the Pacers are probably still going to be in that conversation. The Knicks will be in that conversation. You could argue the Pistons, but again, it's question marks with all of them. And after that, it's a lot of teams in the second tier, right? What do the Heat do? What do the Magic do? There's going to be some changes with those teams, for sure. And you start going down the list, and that's when you go, oh, yeah, path for the Wizards in a couple of years. And, Ben, I know you said this earlier, and I think it's fair, and you're right in terms of the tempering expectations. Of course, you host Locked On Wizards, so you're as immersed in this with the Wizards and every single emotion I think that everybody has with this team. But you know, are you gathering that there is a level of excitement around the how fast this Wizards team can jump to a, and I'm not going to use the word contender, but I'm going to use the word like legitimate playoff team, like middle of the pack playoff team in the Eastern Conference, because this is the most excitement that I've felt around this Wizards team in a long, long time. And I would argue it was that way even before they got the number one overall pick.
I think so, but the one wild card with this whole thing is Anthony Davis, because if he plays a bunch of games, which is never easy to count on at this point because he's always hurt, then you probably feel legitimately good that you can win a lot of games, especially if Trae Young is truly here just as your offensive engine. You get another jump from Sar, Keyshawn George as well. Then, like, yeah, you're looking at a solid team next year in the Eastern Conference. In terms of, like, being middle-tier playoff team where they actually might win a series or two, I don't know if people are feeling that type of way yet about it, but maybe because of what the Spurs have done in 3 years after drafting Wemby, they're in the finals. I know AJ was kind of talking about it at the lottery, saying, you know, if I go to a team, I feel like I can make them into a contender pretty quick. But Victor Wembanyama is not a normal basketball player. Everybody understands that. And they've gotten pretty significant jumps from some of these other guys as well. De'Aaron Fox has been the veteran guy who's kind of let them down in this finals, albeit. But Steph Castle has been incredible through the first 2 years of his career. It is going to take a little bit more time for this Wizards team. And I think people understand that. But there is truly excitement about the team just being watchable again. If you feel like you bring in a box office guy and Trae Young, Anthony Davis, and then, I mean, this has to be music for Ted Leonsis' ears to hear AJ DeBonta saying, I fill the seats. People are going to come see me play. And as a Wizards fan, yeah, you want them to be good. You want them to win. But it is good to see a new energy around the team again at the start.
And it does. Listen, DeBonta is the guy in the end. I think they do take number one overall, but it is clear that they are doing their due diligence and really checking in on Darren Peterson, which you should. And it's The difference, I think, for the Wizards versus a team that maybe, let's say, made a huge jump in the lottery, like, and I'll use an extreme example, but let's say it was the Thunder. If the Thunder had somehow gotten that number one overall pick, which there was an outside chance that they could have, which would have just set the NBA off, I think they could have been somebody that drafts a Darren Peterson number one overall, where there's a talk about, like, higher upside, but, you know, there's some level of risk. But, like, here's the thing, and actually I need to work this with you, Ben, here, because I'm glad I have you with this, because I was trying to figure this out the other day. We talk so much about, like, you know, A.J. DeBons is the guy that you can draft and sleep well at night, and it's true. I get it. But at the same time, Darren Peterson has that killer instinct in him. People just didn't see it at Kansas because he missed a lot of time, and you had the cramping in the creatine, which to me, like, is that the only risk we're talking about with Darren Peterson? Like, really, what is the risk? When people talk about more of a risk with Darren Peterson versus A.J. DeBonsa, like, what is that? Because Darren Peterson is insanely talented, a better defender, a better shooter, and has that killer instinct vibe to him where DeBonsa's not that guy. And when they went head-to-head too, Darren Peterson worked him when Kansas played BYU. So I've tried to work through this, and I can't really figure out, other than the cramping and if you're worried that's going to be something that carries over, but that was supposed to have been creatine and that's really all that it is. Like, is there any other risk that it really involves Darren Peterson other than what maybe he needs to, like, get bigger and he's too skinny?
I think when it comes to Peterson, the risk you run when it's a class this good, and I think there's risk about all these guys because of how top-heavy it is. If you put all of these guys in a vacuum of other number one overall picks over the last 10 years, like Boozer, Peterson, and DeBonsa all could be number one picks in yes. plenty of drafts. It's that good. So the fear or the risk is you don't take the right guy who's going to be the best player. And if AJ is this guy that plays off the wing where we know it's very valuable to build around guys that have superstar level talent off the wing, then yeah, maybe you run into this dilemma where if you draft Peterson, he doesn't really ever develop into a lead guard, because that's, like, one of the concerns I have about him is, like, he's never going to be a point guard long term in the league, which is fine. If you draft him, he's your shooting guard of the future. I don't know what happens with Trey Johnson, who knows, but you just kind of figure it out from there. But if you're drafting him because you think he's the long term solution for Trey Young, I'm not so convinced about that just because of what we saw on tape from him in his college season. I don't buy as much into his high school tape as I do his freshman year at Kansas, but it is interesting because Bill Self had him playing in a completely different role. This is the role he was asked to play at Kansas, so that's why he became a great off-ball player. He's a 99th percentile spot-up player, 94th percentile catch-and-shoot guy. Like, he's one of the best off-ball players. He's much better than A.J. DeBonsa off-ball, but it just depends what you want to build your team around. So if AJ is a guy you want because of the positional flexibility you get off the wing, then that's probably who you go with.
And listen, DeBonsa fits this roster currently and where it is, and fits, you know, an NBA roster guy, 6'9", 6'10", that can play the wing. Like, he is the prototypical, you know, he's what you want in today's NBA. So I totally get it. The Wizards are just in such a good spot, though, because at least you know that there is so much talent that can be taken number one overall where, yeah, you, what if Darren Peterson ends up, let's just play a hypothetical here. Darren Peterson ends up winning an MVP, and A.J. DeBonsa never wins an MVP, but he gets you 23-24 a game and is the best player on the Wizards and is a multi-time All-Star. You're not really going to look back on that and go, God, the Wizards screwed up not drafting Darren Peterson, because A.J. DeBonsa still has a great career. And I think that's what a lot of the questions are going to be with really these top four picks and then some of the other players down. I mean, there's a lot of depth in this draft, too. Make no mistake about it. But you know, you're looking at, you mentioned Boozer. I mean, Caleb Wilson's even another one. These top four picks, Ben, are honestly like, all four right. of them could be number one overall picks in various drafts, where all of them could just have successful careers. Kind of similar to, like, looking at the top three picks in Jaden Daniels' quarterback class, where it's Caleb Williams, Drake May, and Jaden Daniels, and all three of them, at least those quarterbacks, could all have really, really great careers. It's just a matter of, like, who had the better one, who won more of this, or had more passing yards or whatever, but all of them have really, really high floors. I think that's what this top four could be in this NBA draft.
That's the problem with the NBA and the way people evaluate the draft. For some reason, the way a lot of people look at it is if you pick one player, you run the risk that one of the other guys is better by a little bit. But in actuality, the reason these prospects are rated so high, because a lot of people believe, based on the tape and tangibles and other things, that they're all going to be very, very good. NBA players. So just because they take one guy doesn't mean he's not going to be as good as the others, or the other ones are going to be so much better, and it's going to be a huge problem. Like, obviously, if one of the guys was a complete bust, then that'd be an issue. But legitimately, I think all of these dudes at the top three are going to be all NBA-level players, and that includes Boozer, who I think could be in the conversation at one. I think he is that good, and he impacts winning in a big way.
You know, I think about this a little bit going back to the, and it's obviously not the same situation, but there's a similarity here, and it goes back to when the Pelicans and Grizzlies had number one and number two, and it was Zion Williamson and John Morant. At that point, and I remember this, I said it, I think I was at NBC at that point, I can't remember where I was, and it was like, look, I understand Zion's going one. I know they're going to take him number one, but I think that John Morant, and again, this sounds semi-stupid now, I think John Morant has more upside and a potential for a better career, because I'm worried about Zion Williamson and how he's built and him getting hurt and all those things, but I know the Pelicans are going to take him number one, and if it doesn't work out, it's like nobody's going to look back and say they were stupid. It's like you had to take him. Again, a lot of things have changed. It's more John Morant off the court and all of those issues, but in that similarity, it kind of feels that way with this, where it's like, if the Wizards take A.J. DeBonsa and he has a good career, but Darren Peterson's better, it's like, well, everybody understands why you took A.J. DeBonsa. But if you were to take Darren Peterson and he just flops and you pass on A.J. DeBonsa, then it's like it's more blame if you pass on DeBonsa versus taking him and Peterson has a better career. Does that make sense? Like, that's kind of how I view this a little bit, where it's like everybody just understands, like, you got to make this pick, and you expect it to work out, but if it doesn't work out and the other guy hits a higher ceiling, well, you know, you took the safer pick.
Yeah, I think that's a way of looking at it. The way I've said with these both of these guys, they're deserving number one overall picks. One of them has a little bit more questions about the other right now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really what we're down to. But we're 10 days away from the NBA draft. I cannot wait to have that settled, kind of like it was with the Commanders. It was like, for the love of God, I don't know who they're taking at seven, but that was like 10 different names. At least this is two max, so it's a little bit easier to kind of get to that point. Nick Ashew on The Fan. So I've always said that I feel for fan bases that suffer, right? I've experienced it. I mean, look at the Commanders for years. And yes, I've admitted this publicly. I grew up a Knicks fan. So, like, this is awesome for me right now. I love the Wizards. Don't yell at me. I am a Wizards fan, but I grew up a Knicks fan before I moved to Virginia in sixth grade. Like, that's where my roots started. So it's like, and I'll say this, you can have more than one team that you love. You can have more than one. You have to have your original team that you are a fan of, and then you have, like, teams that you like. I think we need to have this at some point. Maybe this is a summer conversation. But your fan tiers, fandom tiers. Right? You got to have, like, your team that you're, die hard from the beginning. Like, that's where your loyalties are. And then there's you either live in a certain city or if you know, for me, it's, cover the team, talked about the Wizards for a million years. No, you come to love the team. You want to see them win, succeed. You're like, that's like the second tier. And then after that, it's just you jump on a bandwagon. Maybe those are the three. Does that work, Ben? Do you think that that's a reasonable aspect to have, like, tiers of fandom? I think it works.
I'm just suited to my DC team, so I just view it differently than everybody else, I guess. But I guess
that's
fair.
Are you born and raised here? I don't remember.
Correct.
Okay, so that's a little different for you. You've never moved.
Right.
So, yeah, so you kind of just have, like, your teams that you were raised on, so it doesn't change. Like, So the reason for me, the reason why I grew up a Redskins fan, but also, like, first a Knicks fan is, as a kid, I lived in New Jersey before I moved to Virginia, and it was like, the Knicks were cool, so, like, I loved the Knicks when I was, like, nine. But my dad has always been, like, the one sport he cares about is football, Redskins, Commanders, like, all that. So it's like, he kind of just inundated me into that world. So that's kind of how I had that. But when you think about it, like, for me, that's two of the most dysfunctional franchises, two of the biggest laughing stocks in sports for a long, long time. So I always feel for fan bases of any team, like the Browns or, you know, insert whatever team you want here, that just continues to be dysfunctional year after year after year because, like, I've been there. I felt it. But if you ever wanted proof that teams can overcome bad ownership, the Knicks are a great example because James Dolan's still the owner of the Knicks. He's not a good owner, but he's kind of stepped away. Like, he's not as involved as he used to be, and it's helped this team a lot because they one, have somebody smart in their front office that turned out to be the right hire in Leon Rose, and the best organizations hire smart people and say, do your job. And you don't interfere. You trust them. You let them do their job. And Leon Rose has proven that he can do the job well as the team president of the Knicks and building a team now that's a win away tonight from winning an NBA championship, which is, I mean, it has eluded this Knicks team for 53 years. So, you know, when you build a team the right way, you have that opportunity. Now, the Commanders are a little bit different because you got rid of the owner. He got booted out. So that's also the miracle, too. Like, really, when you think about it, the two most dysfunctional, I mean, really, if we were to make a group of the most dysfunctional franchises in sports over the last, let's call it two decades, let's call it the 2000s and beyond. From 2000 on, the Knicks are at the top of the list. The Redskins slash Commanders are at the top of the list. The Browns are in there. You could make a list of a bunch of these different ones. But, you know, the Commanders, now new ownership, fresh start, at least from that perspective. That's a hard thing to do, to get an owner booted out. Happened with the Clippers. They would be in that conversation too. And at least now they're a playoff team, right, for them. Like, they're run by an owner. He's a crazy person, but, like, he's kind of a likable crazy person. So you've got that. But for the Commanders to no longer have Dan Snyder owning the team, that was a miracle we thought would never happen. For the Knicks to be in the NBA Finals and still have their owner in place that's not good at what he does, that's a miracle in and of itself. So you can have miracles every once in a while. That's why I feel bad for Browns fans. Browns fans are some of the most passionate fans there are out there, aren't they, right? Like, you ever met a Browns fan, I'd argue even though they're winning, the Bills fans are the same way. They've suffered and suffered, but at least they've had winning seasons. But, like, you lose four straight Super Bowls. Damn, dude. Like, that's rough. That's rough to go through. I get that you're there and it's better than always winning, like, three games, the football team every single year, like the Browns. But, you know, it's a kick in the gut every year to think your team's got a shot and then something falls apart at some point. But, you know, if Browns fans are as passionate about their team as they've ever been, and that is just as dysfunctional of a franchise and a mess that you could possibly have, and they still are. I mean, there's a reason why nobody wanted that job. Todd Monken's their head coach. I mean, nobody wanted that job. Nobody wanted to write the essays. Oh, and the quarterback situation is as bad as it could possibly be in the NFL. I mean, the worst trade and contract in NFL history for Deshaun Watson, who hasn't been a great football player in like 7 years now at this point, still getting paid. The Browns can't figure out quarterback, can't figure out head coach, can't figure out really anything. And really, Kevin Stefanski was a two-time coach of the year. The fact that he was able to get that team to win football games, they're going to see it in Atlanta, which the Commanders see late in the season this year, which is why also, too, I say when it comes to the schedule, guys, we don't really know. What if the Falcons are good? So it's like, oh, the back end of the Commanders' schedule. Kevin Stefanski did a lot in Cleveland. Like, let's also remember what he was able to get out of that. But, yeah, I always have felt bad. Like, I relate to fan bases that have suffered for so many years that really care about their team because you're kind of held hostage. When you have bad ownership, there's nothing you could do. There was nothing we could do as a fan base other than not show up or give any hard-earned money to anything Redskins-related when Dan Snyder was in charge. That was the only way. And he started to make a point, right, when people stopped going late in his tenure and, you know, Eagles fans were dominating the stands late in the season where they only had 3 wins, and it was like, oh, maybe I should hire Ron Rivera. And we thought, well, he's at least a respectable guy. Get it. It didn't win anything, but at least that was one step. But that's how you make your point. It's like the only way. But, yeah, you see the Knicks in the NBA Finals now, and it's like, oh, look at this. They're overcoming what, you know, what is just felt insurmountable for a long time, and they're a win away. They're a win away tonight with that game tonight at 8:30. It has been monster ratings for those NBA Finals, too. But it is proof. You can overcome bad ownership. Nick Ashew on The Fan. I got a tweet from Ziggy who says that the World Cup was better than Z-Quil for him and he fell asleep with it. Come on! U.S. won 4-1! Yeah, he says, yes, I'm a boomer. I don't care. It's great for sleep. Come on! I mean, I didn't watch the whole thing, but I had to get up and do an early show this morning, too. So it's like, I'm not. The game starts at 9. I get it's out there at 6. Hey, look, the U.S. keeps winning. There's going to be more interest in it. Ben, did you watch any of the World Cup?
Yeah, I was out with some friends watching it.
All right, see, like, are you a heavy soccer fan, like, a little bit? Like, what's your level of fandom of just soccer in general?
Not really at all.
Okay, but you were interested in it because it's an event, it's the World Cup, and it's the U.S., right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a good excuse to go out with some friends, have some drinks, you know, start yelling and screaming if something happens.
Exactly.
Just
and
fun.
That's the whole point. Like, this is meant to just, at least bare minimum, you just use it as something that's an excuse to go out and hang out with friends. Like, I'm going to put the games on today when I'm done here. Put them on out in the garage. I'm going to have the NBA Finals game out there tonight, too. I'm not doing a game day garage stream or anything. I need to actually just enjoy the games. But, you know, this is... This is what it's all about. It's just, it's like the Olympics. Like, I don't know anything about the slalom. I don't know anything about most of the winter sports. We know some about the summer. We know some about, like, a few of the winter. Like, you watch hockey, you watch whatever. But, like, people just want to be a part of it. And that's what, like, that's the core of what sports really is. But I'll tell you what, man, it's getting, they're pricing out a lot of fans. The World Cup, the NBA Finals, you're starting to see more of this. And I get it. I get why people are pissed off because, you know, here's the thing. The World Cup could be great on the field or on the pitch, if you will. But off of it, it's a lot of issues. Transportation, prices for stuff. It's people are getting really, really frustrated. And it's been a narrative for a while around the World Cup where it's, okay, wait, let's see if tickets drop. They dropped a little, I think it was like yesterday I saw on average. Now they've kind of gone back up again because what people are doing is they're going to buy them low and then the prices jack back up and it becomes a thing. So, you know, that's the one thing about sports now. It's starting to feel more and more like every event is getting so expensive. You're pricing out a lot of fans. And, I mean, the Super Bowl has been that way for a long time. You know, it's always very corporate, and you're going to have fans that are willing to spend a lot of money and go see their team if it's in the Super Bowl, or you get tickets from somebody, and it's, you know, a big difference maker there. But it's tough. It's tough to see when these events get so expensive, you eliminate a lot of fans that are like, that's not in my budget. I'm not doing that. I don't want to spend that money. I got to allocate it to whatever. Like, that's how the world works sometimes, I get. But, man, it's... The World Cup is like one of those events, especially with the amount of games that are going on. You want to see as many fans involved in this as you possibly can. And then the thing, too, you got to figure out, okay, if you're going to go to a game, you then be able to get the money to go watch, like, your team that you want to see? Or is it just going to be two random teams just so you can go? So I'm a big fan of all these different, you know, summer events, like the Summer Olympics, or again, winter, the Winter Olympics, all that. Even if I don't really care about the teams that are involved, it's just, it's on. It's cool. Like, there's always some interesting storyline that's there, and that's what we gravitate to a lot of it anyway. You know, it becomes, like, think about it. It's what makes the football so great and what makes the NFL so great. College football the same way, but, you know, the NFL is bigger, obviously, here than it is in, you know, an SEC market and city or town or whatever where they're going to care more about that. But your team plays once a week, and there's a lead up to it. And it feels like an event. Football always feels like an event. You may have people over. You may go to a game and you're tailgating or teams on the road. And maybe you're even going to travel, go watch a team on the road or whatever the case is. That is always like the built-in steroid for popularity that football will have is that it's not every day. Now, and that's part of the reason why I just don't want to see the NFL get to a point where they start adding games where it's almost like every day they're playing games because... You take some of the you water it down. It may not be a ton, and sure, they're still going to get monster ratings, but it does water down the what makes football special. And I get it. Look, in the end, it's about money first. I understand all that. But you got to be careful if you're the NFL because you don't want to lose that feeling of eventizing the sport that you have. And, you know, Mark Cuban's talked about this. Other people have talked about this in the past, and you've heard these quotes where it's like, you know, it's essentially saying that if you make it so it's just too available and you give people too much, it's going to hurt the league. And I think that's something the NFL's right on the cusp of right now. 18 games, I hate it. They shouldn't even be playing 17 games. I'd rather them expand the playoffs. At least those games feel more meaningful, but we know what's going to happen. It's going to be 18 games. Like, we're going to get that at this point. But you start getting these games on Wednesdays, and they're finding other times to play them, and it's like, even on Christmas, I get it, I'm an NBA guy first, I love the NBA, and I love the NBA on Christmas Day, but it's not like I'm not going to watch the NFL, and the only thing that people watch live anymore is sports, or something politics, like a debate or something, right? That's it. Nobody watches anything live anymore. It's all on demand. It's all on Netflix and Hulu and Prime and Apple TV and every other platform that you can imagine. So what brings people all together in the moment? Sports. That's it. So networks or tech companies or whoever are willing to pay a premium to drive people to the same spot, to the same thing at the same time, where then you can inundate them with ads and all types of marketing and sell all that ad space and you make a lot of money. Like, again, the business plan makes sense. That's what makes sports the vehicle for that. It will always be the case because sports is always the best live. I can't even watch a game on, like, delayed DVR, anything like that. My dad can do that. My dad can watch a Commanders game and it's like an hour and a half into it and he's like, I haven't started yet. I want to go through the commercials. I'm like, how do you do it? And then I realize, oh, wait, he's not really on any social media. Doesn't care. So like, oh, that's why. Like, I can't do that. No, granted, even if it's like, again, Commanders, I'm doing stuff for that. Like, I'm going to need to be live. So it's different. But even if it's a random game that I don't have any like work-related things to do for it, I can't watch it on delay. You can rewatch it. But that's a different thing. It's already done, and I know what happened. To watch a game knowing that I'm like an hour behind and the whole world knows what's going on, it's jarring, and it's awful, and I hate it. It's just, it's terrible. I could never do it, but some people do it. But it's brutal. I mean, it really is to do it. But that's why sports is so valuable now. And look, the NFL is going to keep renegotiating. The NFL is going to be going to NBC. Hey, Sunday Night Football should be more. They've already said, like, they've basically said the inside thought out loud. Because technically, NBC is paying the NBA more for the NBA package. It's more games. It's not just one game once a week. But the NFL is like, hold on, our ratings are bigger than the NBA, and you pay us $1 billion, and you pay the NBA more than $1 billion. That's not fair. That's not right. We have to be the king. So they're going to want to fight that and try to renegotiate it, and it's going to get to the point where YouTube and Netflix and Amazon and maybe even Apple TV they've got the cash and they've got the deep pockets and they can pay more to leagues like the NFL, where even the biggest networks in this country are going to be like, we can't even afford that anymore. And then what's left? I guess changing is changing fast. So if you hate how sports are spread out on all these platforms now, just wait. Because it's going to keep happening. And then everybody's going to come together. I'm telling you, just get ready. You're going to have everything on similar. You can already get like HBO stuff on Prime, and like Hulu's got HBO. Like, everybody's putting all their content on other things anyway. Eventually you'll be able to have one or two apps, and guess what it's going to be? Oh, like cable again. It's all going to be bundled together. It's all just going to be cyclical. You'll just get more because it's on an app and it's not just live TV and that's it. This world is moving fast, man. Get ready. Nick Ashew on the Fan.